I want to thank you, Lisa, for sharing, open yourself up to us like that, helping us understand and say goodbye. Thank you just for sharing of your life like that. I want to level with you this morning. I'm just going to be upfront about it. I really dislike Santa Claus. I really, really do not like him. I mean, I grew up with him in my household. And, you know, when I became a Christian, I was like, who is this guy? What is he doing in this holiday? You know, he distracts from the real meaning of Christmas. There's all this ridiculous music about him. And there's all this magical hoopla. Plus, you know, the actual St. Nicholas, the historical figure St. Nicholas, who was a historical figure, he was a real bruiser. And he would have a lot to say about what has become of his image if he were here, in fact, and it would not be pretty. So in spite of all this, though, I just want to say that this year I have begun to rethink my hatred of Santa Claus. I've actually begun to think about it a little bit and reconsider because of this one moment that has to happen in a household where Santa Claus is welcomed during Christmas time. This one moment, this thing that happens to any child, usually pretty young, and it happens, it's inevitable, and that moment just makes it worth it. It's when a small child recognizes and realizes that this one, this mysterious visitor, he's very mysterious, you know, this one who has all of these powers and these flying reindeer, and, you know, he has an ability to know what you've been doing for the whole year. This kind of omniscience, you know, and he has this ability to go around the whole globe in one night, you know, and all of these resources from which the best presents come, all of these vast resources that has, you know, all of these toys come out of it, all this person, there's this moment when he realizes something about, the child realizes something about this mysterious visitor, and I think it's well kind of characterized, it was kind of well captured in this song, this old song, I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus. How many of you remember that old song? Anybody still? Okay, yeah, remember this. Actually, it's a great old song. And it's that moment, it captures that moment when the small child realizes, and by the way, this is a spoiler alert, is if you welcome Santa Claus into your household, you might want to just put your hands over your kids' ears for a moment. Or if you're watching, just, you know, tell them to put their fingers in their ears just for this next sentence. But it's when the child realizes this one who's given all of these great gifts actually is my own dad, is this one who is the head of my household. He's the one I know already. All of these things actually are found in him, in this guy, in my own household. And that one moment, that might be worth it. That might be worth all the hoopla. Because that actually tells us the true meaning of Christmas. What do I mean by that? Well, let me explain. Christians have always sung songs. Christians have always been singing. From the very beginning, they were singing things. They were singing in carols and hymns and songs. Always been singing. And in the last, I would say, half a century or so, scholars have begun to recognize that some of those songs have ended up in the New Testament. There are actually fragments of these songs, carols, and hymns that have been incorporated into the writings of the apostles. And the apostle Paul sometimes actually may very well be quoting a current song at the time. And one of those songs, it seems, according to the majority of scholars, has ended up in Colossians chapter 1. And I've been really happy, I've been very excited that we've been going through Colossians and we're going to be doing it over Christmas so that we could actually look at this very passage in some detail. The passage is Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 through 20. I wonder if you would stand with me as I'm going to read this, well, if it was a song, one that gives the real true meaning of Christmas. And again, it's Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 through 20. I'll be reading in the ESV version, so you can read along in your Bibles if you have them, or you can it can be up on the screen as well. All right, I hope that wasn't about Santa Claus. Sorry if I wrecked it there, but okay, no, this is Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 through 20. He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. And he's the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in everything he might be preeminent. For in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. And this is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Please make yourself comfortable. You know, you can kind of get lost in a passage like this. You know, it's one of these passages where you can read and there's a lot of big thoughts, right? A lot of strange expressions, and you read something like this and you might say, well, I know something important is being said. I know this is deep, but what is he saying exactly? So a number of passages like in the Apostle Paul that, you know, you read things and what is he saying? What is he actually saying? Well, he's talking about the visit of a mysterious visitor. And what I'm going to be talking about this morning, for that I'm indebted to two scholars I want to name, because I just want to give them credit for my exegesis this morning. They were very helpful in me understanding the passage this morning. One of them, his name is Herman Ridderbos. He's a Dutch theologian. And the things that he wrote has been very helpful to me in understanding this very passage. The other one, his name is Lane Tipton, and he is an American scholar, a systematic theologian. And what these two have written actually has been very helpful for me in actually getting at what Paul is saying here. In fact, Ridderbos says that if you want to understand what the Apostle Paul thinks of Christ, if you want to understand what the Apostle Paul is trying to say about Christ, this is the passage, this is the keystone of his understanding of who he was. That these six verses are where you start for all of the writings of the Apostle Paul to tell you what he actually thought about Christ. These six verses here. And so what we see him doing is introducing us to someone. Right? He's talking about the identity of this mystery visitor who seems to have amazing powers and resources that has loomed up on our horizon. So I want to look at it with you if we can. And the first thing I want to start with is this word, image. Or in Greek, it's icon. The image of the invisible God. Now, that could mean two different things. The image of the invisible God. It could mean, first of all, that this one is the one who makes God visible, right? It could be talking about what Craig was talking about earlier a lot of, the incarnation, where God became man. Suddenly, the invisible God became visible, right? It could mean that this is the image, one who makes him visible. Or it could mean that he was actually the same thing, that he is actually the same thing as the invisible God, which they're both invisible. Like when you take an image of your hard disk, right? If you take an image of the hard disk, it's the hard disk, right? You've got the same thing in the hard disk, right? That could be the second way. If that's the case, then it's a much more cosmic statement. It's a saying that I'm talking about this one who's preexistent, who is actually the same thing as what we call God in that case. Now, what I'm going to argue with you this morning is that it's the latter. It's the second one. That's what it's meaning. Might be tempting to think, well, I was talking about, you know, when he became a man. But there's a few things that tell us Paul is actually saying the second thing. That's the meaning of image. The first is that word is that he highlighted. That's in the continuous present tense. And it could very well be a timeless present. That is speaking about something that's eternal. Whereas the incarnation, what we talk about, God becoming man, that's something that happened in time, right? There was a time it wasn't, and then it became that, right? But this is sort of seems to be saying something eternal. But more important than the grammar is this other title that he has given, and that is the firstborn. The second thing that he's called is the firstborn of all creation. If he's the firstborn of all creation, at the very least, first of all, he's around at the beginning of creation, which was long before the time of the incarnation, right? It's before things were made, at the beginning of when things were made. So it kind of gives you a sense that he's talking about something about this guy that was true from eternity, his glorious past, before things, anything was made, much less the incarnation happened. But it really comes down to the meaning of this expression, the firstborn of all creation. What does that mean? What does it mean to say you're the firstborn of all creation? Now, we have a hard time understanding that because in our culture, we don't have quite the same thing. But in the biblical cultures, in the times in which the Bible was written, the firstborn was a very important concept. The firstborn son of every family was the one to whom most of the inheritance passed, and it was the one to whom all the responsibility passed for the family. So the firstborn son was the one who became the guy in charge. He had responsibility for all of the extended household, all the clan, right? It was the firstborn son. So what the firstborn really is communicating is that this is the one who to whom authority is given. This is the one who has all the authority, okay, of the household or whatever it is you're talking about. And that's why you can read in different places in your Bible. Like if you go to Psalm 89, you see something like this. And I will make him the firstborn, the highest of the kings of the earth. It's like, what does that have to do with each other? Well, it's because he's the one in charge. He's the one in authority. In fact, if you're reading your Bible, here's a good tip. If you're reading your Bible and you come to the word firstborn, this is the first thing you should think of. This is what they're communicating, because this is what they would understand, the original audience, is that this is the one who's in charge. This is the one who's the master of whatever it is you're talking about, the household or whatever, because he's like the firstborn son of a family. Okay, and that makes a lot of things make sense. So if you go to another passage, for example, in the New Testament, like 1 Timothy 2, and here we have the same principle at work. If you don't realize that, it doesn't make any sense. When Paul says, I do not permit a woman to exercise her authority or teach in the context of close relationships of a church, for Adam was formed first and then Eve. Now, if on the face of that, you read it and you're like, well, that sounds ridiculous. Like, why does it matter who came first? But Paul's drawing on the same principle of the firstborn. Adam was like the firstborn of the family. Because he came first, God is saying something about their relationship between Adam and Eve and their children, that in close relationship, Adam has a certain place of responsibility and authority. And that's what makes passages like this make sense. So if you go back to our passage and you say firstborn of all creation, that doesn't mean that he's the first thing that came out of creation, like he was the first thing created. No, it means he's in charge of creation. It means he's the master of creation. He's why creation happened. He's how creation happened. He's the one who has authority over all creation. He was given the mission of creation. And that's why you can see these things that come up afterwards, like thrones and dominions and rulers and authorities. What is he talking about? He's talking about this mystery one being in charge of it all. Right? And in the context of this, he's in charge of creation. So this whole first stanza of this song, if this were a song, okay, this would be the first stanza of the song. It's talking about creating and creation because he is the master of this. He is the one in charge of this. This is not something abstract for us, friends. This is very important. What does this mean for us? It means that in relation to God, he is the image. In relation to creation, he is the firstborn. He is the given. He is the one with the mission of making everything that we know. And that brings us to another thing I really dislike about Christmas. Okay, and for me personally, it's wrapping presents. Okay, wrapping presents. Like, you know, what's the point? You're gonna wrap something up, and then it's just gonna be torn off the thing, right? And when I try to do it, it never works. It never comes out well. You know, and then you have to, it's all this wrapping paper you have to get. You have to go and buy paper. It just bothers me. It's just, what a waste, right? You go to the store and buy paper. Like, why not just use newspaper? You already have that around, you know? It's kind of artistic. I don't know. Maybe it's just me. How many people here like wrapping presents? Raise your hand. Raise them high. Okay, let me say something to you people. You are more righteous than I. Okay. I can't stand wrapping paper, but I do like receiving presents. I do like getting them, you know. Do you ever get a present and it's exquisitely wrapped? I mean, just beautifully wrapped, and it makes you feel like, wow, this person put a lot of time into me. This person was thoughtful of me. And then you open it up, and it's something that it just you really want it. It's really going to make your life better. And you think, wow, what do you think? Like, well, that person really thought a lot about me. Maybe it was a secret Santa or something, and you didn't know who it was who gave it to you. And then the moment you find out who it was who really gave it to you, what do you feel like? You feel like, wow, this person, I'm so important to this person. They've wrapped it so beautifully. It's just what I need. It's something that tells you you're loved, right? It's something that brings a smile to your face. Well, let me tell you something, folks. Creation is a series of beautifully wrapped Christmas presents. That's what creation is. It's this exquisitely wrapped series of incredible presents that took unimaginable planning. You know, I appreciated what Lisa was sharing about what creation really ministered to her, learning about creation. Because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about more planning than you have no idea, the kind of planning that's gone in to every molecule of creation that you enjoy. He took charge as the firstborn to make this for you. And there are so many myriad details that went into his creating. It's mind-boggling. It's not abstract, so that you would feel loved. Take this very thing, your smile. Okay, take the smile itself. Okay, here's what I'd like you to do, if you would humor me. I'd like you to turn to the person next to you and smile. And you know, even if you're wearing a mask, maybe you could just pull it down, hold your breath or something, and pull it down, just so the person can see your smile and look at their smile. Just do it once for me, okay? No, Veronica, not with your lips closed, with your lips open. I mean a real smile. Give her a real smile. Come on. You have a beautiful smile. I want to see it. Yeah. That's great. I can do that to her. Okay, so, yeah, what is that? It's so beautiful. It brings you so much happiness, isn't it? Just to see a smile, just to have a smile. Let me tell you something. You know the reason that you have that smile, especially in our culture, that smile lasts for a long time? If we were in a different culture, it might, you know, your teeth would start falling out and stuff, you know? You know how come? There's a reason that you have that smile, and it lasts so long. The answer is fluoride. It's fluoride. Because there's fluoride, it's naturally occurring in our waters, and in the right amount, it actually builds your teeth. Before you're 6 years old, fluoride comes in and actually helps your teeth become strong. Dentists can always tell the difference between someone who comes into their office who has had fluoride in their life and one who has not, because their teeth are soft. You can talk to dentists about this. And before you're 6 years old, it is building your teeth. But even after you're 6 years old, it actually remineralizes your teeth. It acts as a catalyst in your mouth so that when you have fluoride, in the presence of fluoride, your teeth actually get stronger. That's why it prevents tooth decay. That's why scientists have said, let's try to get it into our water in the right supply, in the right amounts. Let's try to get into our toothpaste. because it actually strengthens your teeth. It's the reason why you have that smile. It's the reason you can keep that smile because of fluorine. Because fluoride is a mineral, and it comes from fluorine. Well, where does fluorine come from? Hugh Ross, in his great book, The Creator and the Cosmos, he goes into kind of the balance, the delicate balancing of factors that make life on our planet, that even make life possible on our planet. And he mentions the difficulty of making these heavier elements, they're called heavy elements, something heavier than hydrogen and helium, and how difficult that is for that to happen in the universe. And heavy elements like fluorine here are only produced through stars, a process of the stars living and dying. They only come about through this process of a star going through a burning process, living and then dying. Now, let me tell you, even a short-lived star lives about 50 million years. It takes about 50 million years for that to happen. And that's the big one. The bigger the star, the shorter the life. And that's the big ones. A star like our sun, it lasts more like on the average of billions of years. But at least 50 million years. And that's what it takes. What I have here is a picture of one of these exploding stars that is expelling material into interstellar space from which we can get heavy elements. And this one is the Helix Nebula. It's a beautiful thing, but it's also the reason why we can get heavy elements. But that's not all that you need. He had to set the gravitational constant to just the right value, so that stars would burn in a way to create heavy elements. Otherwise, we would just have hydrogen and helium. That's all we would have. But not only that, he had to set the ratio between the electromagnetic force constant and the gravitational force constant to just the right value, to within 1 to 10 to the 40th decimal places. 1 to 10 to the 40th decimal place. That's an unimaginably small number. A little bit more, a little bit less wouldn't have worked. But he set it to just the right value so that it would work. And he also had to give us the right number of baryons. Those are, you remember, the nuclear particles, protons and neutrons, the heavy things that make for the mass of the universe. He had to give us just the right number of baryons. If there's too little, stars would burn too quickly. If it was too much, then the heavy elements wouldn't be produced. Just the right amount. And do you know how much that amount was? 100 billion trillion stars. That's how much was needed. 100 billion trillion stars. Now that is a lot of wrapping paper. But it was all needed in order to give us these heavy elements. It also, he had to set the right frequency of stars dying out. And by the way, we have just the right frequency in our galaxy. And we're in just the right place in our galaxy. If we were too close to the center of the Milky Way, we'd be bombarded with radiation. You couldn't have life. If we were too far away to the edge of the galaxy, we wouldn't be picking up the heavy elements. We're just in the right place for it. But you know, when you come to fluorine, fluorine doesn't just, I was going to say grow on trees. Of course, it doesn't. But it doesn't just come from any supernovae explosions. Fluorine is something really particular. It's only made on the surface of a white dwarf star. Here's a picture of a white dwarf star. Now, white dwarf stars are stars that have burned through all their nuclear fuel, and now they're just the embers left that have shrunk down. It's sort of like your wood stove on the next morning, right? The morning after. That's a white dwarf. And a white dwarf, because of the surface, things on the surface, the qualities of the surface of the white dwarf star, this is where fluorine could be made. But you know what? It can't just be any white dwarf star. It has to be a white dwarf star that is in a binary system with a larger star that is orbiting it. Why? Because it needs to draw material from that larger star to the surface of the white star, and then it needs to be expelled into the universe, into interstellar space, that it might be picked up by a planetary system like ours that is forming. Incredible the amount of detail here. You have to have just the right number of binary white dwarfs to do this. If you have too many binary white dwarfs in your area, it'll disrupt the planetary orbits. You couldn't have planets orbiting a sun. If there are too few, you wouldn't get enough fluorine. This is the only way that fluorine is made in enough quantity to be able to be released and gathered as a planetary system is forming. And this is the way it is right here where we have it. And on the surface of the Earth, it turns out, because of these conditions, every one of these minute details, we have fluorine in the quantity that it ended up in your water, that it ended up strengthening your teeth so that you could smile. That's a wrapping job. Not only did he give you this gift so that you would smile, it's the smile itself that he's giving you because of his love for you. And this is just one. You can multiply this one detail by a million. This is what it means to say he is the firstborn of creation. He has been the master of all of these things to give them to you so you would understand how he thinks about you, how much he thinks about you. All of them wrapped up for you. And you know what? This is just the first stanza that we go through. Paul goes on after creation and talks about what we might call providence, that before all things, he holds all things together. In him, all things are held together, in verse 17 there. That means he didn't only create all things, he sustains all things. They don't hold together by themselves. I mean, we slap labels on it when we don't understand. We say, oh, that's the strong nuclear force or something like that. But actually, we really don't understand. He's holding it all together. You know, if there's anything that this year should have taught us, it is that life is fragile, that we are vulnerable, right? If anything should have taught us that, it's this year. Because if you take something like COVID-19, it's not even a particularly deadly virus. You know, it's not as deadly for people who are young, right? But if there were a war of the worlds, the right microorganism could wipe us out just like that. If you had a microorganism that was as deadly as Ebola, let's say, and as contagious as influenza, you know, we could be gone like that. And he's holding it together. That could happen to us, hasn't happened to us together. Now, you might look at this, what I'm calling the providence of God, the governing, the ongoing governing of this one, that he is governing all things to work out for his purposes, for the good. You might say, I don't think so. Not what I see going on in my life. You know, I was recently talking to a Unitarian, actually an agnostic. It's a big umbrella, Unitarian. So this Unitarian is an agnostic. And I was talking about how he governs all things. All things he's looking after for the good. And this person said, no, he isn't. My friend said to me, you know, if he is governing this, he needs to get his act together. He needs to get his act together. Because this is not good governance. He said it with such disdain. I said, well, depends on what you think good governance is. Depends on whether you think that hardship, even loss, with things as they are, is not good governance. But I'll tell you, I've watched your lives this year. And I can tell you that it becomes very clear to me that some very good things have come out of even the bad things of this year. Even the bad things, I've watched how he can turn them to good. Isn't that true? He can take those bad things and turn it to good. That is powerful governance. He does. And sometimes you have to realize that he uses pain, as C.S. Lewis famously put it, right? Pain is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. And sometimes that is the way it is functioning in our lives. If you can't see that, it does not bode well for you. He is holding all things together. But that's the first stanza. Then the second stanza, again, we find he's talking about the firstborn. But this firstborn is the firstborn is a parallel of the first one. That's one of the reasons they think it's a song. Now it's the firstborn of the one who rose from the dead, of the one who is reconciling all things and making peace. That is, he is not only the firstborn of creation, he's the firstborn of the new creation. He's the firstborn of redemption as well. That's what this second stanza is about. He's the trailblazer of all who will rise. He's the one who brought resurrection into history. And all of these difficult things that we're dealing with, all of these things that cause hopelessness in us, he's the one who brought resurrection. That means that it wasn't a thing before him. Before him, there wasn't resurrection. There wasn't this rise again. But since him, he has ushered it into history. That's how much of a firstborn, that's how much of a guy in charge he is. He's brought resurrection into our history to give it to us. And I think the most beautiful part of this whole passage that tells us why he brought it in. He says the reason that he brought it in, really three things that it says. He says, verse 18, so that he would be preeminent over all. And verse 19, he rose because the fullness of God dwelt in him. So you see, what happened in the resurrection? We look at the resurrection of this one. We see his identity revealed. We see his supremacy manifested. Because of his identity and who he was, he had to rise. He had to rise because the fullness of God dwelt in him, because he was the Lord of life. He had to rise, and that revealed who he was to us. And you know what it says? If I could just mention this, it's the most wonderful thing, is that it tells us that who he really is who he is for us, that we see who he actually is in himself by what he does. In se pro nobis. Who he actually is, we see manifested in the things that he does for us. He is who he is for us. Amazing. And so this mystery visitor is not only one who brings cheer, he's the one who reconciles all bad things to the good. All right, who is this mysterious visitor? Because you notice he's not named in the passage, right? He's sort of like this mysterious one. Who is he? And we saw in the beginning, he's the image of the invisible God, right? He is the same of the same substance. And in verse 19, we see he is the fullness of God. The fullness of God. That is, there is nothing that God is which he lacks. There is nothing whom God is that is not present in him. He's the fullness of God. And all things, verse 16, all things are for him. All things are for him. So he's not only the master of creation and providence and the new creation. He's the goal. He's the reason for all of these things. That's where they're all going. They're all for him. So you see, what we got in the incarnation is the real gift giver, is God himself. And you know, if this really is a early Christian song, as the majority of scholars believe, it tells us something. And that was that Jesus Christ was worshiped as God from the very beginning. You know, every Christmas, every Easter, you'll see in the mainstream media, they'll roll out this narrative. Oh, Jesus of Nazareth, he was just a Jewish teacher, and he just taught about being good. And later on, people developed this idea that he was God and worshiped him. No, friends, doesn't fit. Doesn't fit the facts of history. This is one of the earliest writings ever of who Christ was. One of the earliest writings ever, the early 50s, hardly more than 20 years after he lived. And if Paul is quoting a song, which he doesn't even have to explain, he doesn't stop and say, I know this is confusing. Let me try to explain what I'm saying here, why I can say these things about this one. He doesn't say that. It means it's already accepted. He expected them, the people that he was writing to, already know this, right? That tells us from the very beginning, he was worshiped. He was worshiped as this one to whom all things come, for whom all things are. From the very beginning. And so that brings us to the bridge. The bridge of the song is in the middle there. And this bridge tells us something about who this one is that directly relates it to us. Right? This one that we've been talking about, this amazing one, who is the great gift giver, who is the one who's holding all things together, who is the author of the new creation, who's going to make all things well in our lives. This one is the head of the body. He's the head of our own household. He's the one who's, we saw the blood on his cross. We know him. We know him already all along. This is the one that we know, the revelation of the mystery of the one of power. The secret Santa who has given you all of these gifts, he's the one in your own house whom you can know. So you see what verse 18a is? Verse 18 there. That's that moment when the child creeps downstairs. He's supposed to be in bed. And he sees mommy kissing Santa Claus. That's that moment when the revelation of this great one with all these strange powers, all of these ways that make us happy and joyful, that bring smile to our face. He's the one in our very own household. The one that we know. Boy, it's enough to make you sing, right? I saw mommy kissing Santa Claus underneath the mistletoe last night. Oh, what a laugh it would have been if daddy had only seen mommy kissing Santa Claus last night. Right? Thank you. Thank you very much. So what do you think? Should we reevaluate Santa in our lives? Nah. Let's stick with the real thing. Let's celebrate the real gift giver. Would you stand with me right now? And, you know, the session has asked that we bring our live stream service to a close here at this time to dismiss those who aren't with us. So we're going to do that now with our benediction. Before I close, I want to remind you that part of our worship is giving. It's an important part of biblical worship. So we want to remind you to give. If this is your church, we remind you to give here. Remind you to keep on praying. And we want to say that Ultimate Frisbee will be happening today. It is happening. And as we announced this week on Christmas Eve, we want to invite you to come. If you have never experienced an Ironworks Christmas Eve service, let me tell you, it is something special. Becky does this wonderful job for us, and it really is something that is transportive. So we invite you to join us on Christmas Eve, either here in person or on the live stream as well. And with that, let me bring us, what? One more song first? I beg your pardon. Oh, great, we get to sing. Probably a better song than I was singing, right? Let's sing.